Welcome to Global Television. This is Stephen Pidgeon. I'm going to be taking the place of Scott Bennett here tonight on our discussion of a worldwide geopolitical analysis. We're going to kind of take this from the top, and we're going to be exploring some things that hopefully will shed light on our current situation. I'm very excited about this broadcast because this broadcast is a preamble to unfolding events which promise to be quite a substantial change in the condition of the world over the next several years. In fact, we're expecting an enormous change in the next several months. So we're going to discuss this, and we're going to discuss this on a global basis, taking it from the top. Unfortunately, Scott will not be here. He's currently away from his desk. So it's going to be mostly on my shoulders to be able to deliver this content and this discussion. And we are going to be dealing with it. So with that being said, let's kind of see if we can spearhead this discussion in a certain visual and in a certain way. And let me see if I can just capture that real quickly. And we'll put it on screen so that we've got something to go by here. Just one moment. And we'll do this. Let's see, where are we here? Here we go. So as I say, we're going to be dealing with a global analysis and a geopolitical analysis, if you will. So let's take a look. In our discussion tonight, we're going to be talking about the tenets of disparity, the forces of engagement, conflicting worldviews, and corruption. These four topics are going to lead the tenets of our discussion. So let's begin here with the tenets of disparity. Now, we're going to see some interesting pressures that are existing throughout the world. Dynamics, which have been in place for quite some time, but the dynamic properties are in the process of substantial changes. To give you an example, we saw the rise over a long period of time, really from the Industrial Revolution forward, the rise of the British Empire. Now, the British Empire would come to be an empire upon which the sun never set, whether it was colonizing and controlling India, which at that time not only included India, but also Pakistan and also Bangladesh, all kind of hovering under the auspices of Queen Victoria. British East Africa, which was obtained through colonization. British South Africa, which was obtained by conquest, where the British actually made war against Dutch colonists, Boers in South Africa, creating for the first time really in modernity concentration camps where Dutch, men and women of Dutch descent and French descent were held in concentration camps. Some 42,000 women and children died in those camps during the Boer Wars, sponsored by Great Britain against the colonists in South Africa. That also is going to create an interesting disparity and an interesting dynamic where we are today. The British, of course, also expanded and populated the continent of Australia, initiating it as a penal colony, where prisoners who were facing capital punishment in Great Britain could elect to expatriate and instead move into Australia and New Zealand. And so this was, and I left out, of course, Canada, which was completely dominated by Britain, and the Crown was directly supervisory over the whole of the nation of Canada. Now, this would eventually cause a separation and a breakaway that took place in the latter part of the 20th century. But we can see that the British Isles and the British Commonwealth were replete in dominance throughout the world. And I forgot to mention, of course, Hong Kong, which was a big part of this equation. This British dominance would cause the English language to become the dominant language of trade and commerce throughout the world, as it remains today. It's not only the dominant language of trade and commerce, but it's also the dominant language of the aerospace industry, that when you fly, pilots are required to know the English language in order to get instruction from the towers, who are also required to know the English language. So the question is, this flux that took place really as a result of Britain obtaining an advantage in the Industrial Revolution through the promulgation of the steam engine and other devices. But that really was not the methodology that propelled Britain forward. Rather, it was the free marketplace of ideas that was enshrined in the common law in Britain that caused the explosion of intellectual growth that would later allow the English-speaking people to impose themselves on other cultures. And this idea, it was the idea of capturing a greater level of thought through a marketplace of trial and error, where people were free to speak that which was necessary in the identification of reality. The freedom of speech, of course, is the central tenet of disparity because, well, it's one of the tenets. I'm going to talk about the second tenet here in a minute. But the first tenet is the ability to speak freely in an intellectual marketplace. Because in order to determine the validity of an idea, the idea must first be spoken, and then it must be debated and challenged and countered so that you can say, well, this is a great idea. Well, no, it isn't. Well, why not? Because blah, 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 blah. One, two, three, and four. And then the contrary affirmative would come back and say, well, no, it is a strong idea because of A, B, C, and D. And then, of course, when the prevailing topic begins to rise, then, of course, action can be taken. And the next thing you know, you have a steam engine. Or the next thing you know, you have mass production. And it was these kinds of things that allowed Britain to move ahead to colonize really the four corners of the earth. Now, this created a paradigm that has been dominant now since, let's call it the 1500s, but arguably it began to succeed in earnest in the 1700s. And with the rise of the German leadership in Britain, following William and Mary of Orange. And we become even more dominant under the tutelage of Queen Victoria. Now, some of that was also done at the point of a gun. And this is something that Mao said, Chairman Mao once said, that, you know, all power comes from the barrel of a gun. Well, this is not true. I mean, ultimately, it is a fact that there is power at the end of at the barrel of a gun. But the true power, as expressed in Sun Tzu or in Lao Tzu, does not come from the barrel of a gun, but comes from the mind, because the war is won before the first shot is fired. This concept, I'm sure, is understood in the Asian mind, generally speaking. And as a rule, then, we can see that it was the intellectual prowess that was developed from an intellectual free marketplace of ideas that allowed English to rise to the language of the commercial markets throughout the world. Now, this is in flux right now because of the capitulation of the crown. So we have seen Great Britain in really a dramatic free fall from this powerful commonwealth at the time of Queen Victoria to hedging its bets, having to fight two catastrophic wars in Europe in the 20th century, which removed generations of Brits from their place, and only to find themselves being replaced by mass migration. And the war that is currently ongoing in Europe is a war that is being fired without a shot. This is not being discussed anywhere because the tools of warfare are not what you would expect. The tools of warfare being used in Europe have to do with demography or the demographic reality on the ground. And this is a long throw, if you will, a long throw battle plan. That is, if you can talk the Europeans into not having any children, and then you can bring immigrants in who are having children, it's not going to be very long before the immigrants are going to overtake these democracies and hold a majority vote capable of dethroning all of the existing political power base in Western Europe and reestablishing political systems that are common to a different worldview other than the worldview that was developed in Europe over the last 500 years. This is what's going on, and this war is being won not by Europeans, but by non-Europeans on the continent of Europe who are winning this war. And of course, the thinking inside of Europe is, well, we will win this war by assimilating these immigrants into our population. But the assimilation is not really working. And this is because of the disparity in worldview. And we're going to deal with that disparity. We're going to look at a little bit more of this disparity when we get in farther into this discussion, in particular about the differences in worldview that are beginning to change the demography of the entire world. Now, I can to give you an example how bad the demographics are in Europe. Earlier last year, there was a three-month period of time in the nation of Italy when there was not a single child born, period, in the whole country, not one child. Now, you can rest assured that there were tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of people who died at the same time, which would cause, of course, a population diminution. And we're seeing that diminution all throughout Western Europe as the replacement rate required to be 2.3 children for every adult is not 2.3. In fact, it used to be hovering around 1.8, but now you're talking about a demographic replacement rate below 1.0, hovering at 0.8, 0.9 in this area. Throughout Spain, Portugal, France, Italy, Germany, Holland, Belgium, all of these nations are suffering a demographic collapse. And this kind of collapse is almost irreversible in a given number of generations. Like you're looking at something to the tune of three generations before this can be recovered. And this is with a concerted effort to reestablish this base. So what are the disparities now? We see the disparities of nations who did not speak English being excluded from the table of conversation. And this would become a pretty rough and tumble affair. Now, some nations would be happy to speak English, but intended on asserting their sovereignty. To give you an example, the Empire of Japan wanted to assert its sovereignty. Now, Japan was a very interesting geopolitical case when you go back into the 19th century. Because Japan had embraced modernity suddenly. They came out of a Shintoist society that was basically dependent upon a warrior class of people, fighting on behalf of the emperor, living a really kind of a classic but independent Japanese style of life, and with the samurai situation and so forth. And this would all of a sudden embrace modernity suddenly. Well, we like technology. We're going to use it. Let's build modern ships. Let's engage in this. And so the Japanese culture was very quick to embrace all of the tenets of the Industrial Revolution and its benefits and began to industrialize at a very, very competitive level. And they still exist at a very competitive level where you're talking about Mitsubishi or Matsushita or Honda. Or Yamaha, any of these really kind of spectacular, Hitachi, some of these spectacular industrial companies that have operated out of Japan, capable of invention, mechanical engineering, and industry, and so forth, at the very highest level. Now, we have seen this has now been met with the unleashing of China and the move away from the doctrines of Mao and the hard communist tenets into a state-run market economy. And so now we see China embracing industrialization, manufacturing, and so on and so forth at the very highest levels and pushing itself in the same way. We also see it coming out of Vietnam, where, by the way, the products coming out of Asia, when you look to quality, we often find the highest quality in Asia coming out of products coming out of Asia, coming out of Vietnam, where the furniture is built well, the clothing is built well, so on and so forth. So the Vietnamese have really stepped up to the plate in terms of becoming a viable player in this modern world. However, look at the situation when you're still required to do commerce in English and then piggybacked with the idea that not only do you do commerce in English, but you have to spend the American dollar to do this commercial transaction. And so the dollar was more or less forced on the world through the Bretton Woods Agreement in 1973 under Richard Nixon, who colluded with the oil producing exporting countries, OPEC. He colluded with OPEC to get OPEC to agree to express the sale of any petroleum product anywhere in the world only in dollars on the condition that the United States military would always defend its interests. Well, this was a very interesting coalition and a very interesting arrangement, because this was put the United States in between a rock and a hard spot when it came to the nation of Israel. Because now we see that the United States has to, on one hand, defend Israel with, you know, with a basically a blank check, the same kind of blank check that the German kingdom had given to the Austrian-Hungarian emperor at the rise of World War I. It's the same kind of blank check that the United States has given to Israel, the same kind of blank check that the United States has given to Ukraine. And so because of this, the U.S. is in complete breach of its agreement to defend the interest of the oil-producing and exporting countries, OPEC country. And so the OPEC countries, of course, are now breaching their agreement to respect the transaction only in dollars. So what we have seen now was we went through this convulsion of World War I and World War II, which were really the same war with a pause in between for rearming. And the rearming took place as quickly as everybody could put it together, and then back at it again. And at the end of this war, what happened was America succeeded into prosperity primarily because the manufacturing and industrial base in Japan had been bombed into oblivion, and the manufacturing and industrial base in Germany had been bombed into oblivion, the two chief competitors to American manufacturing and industry. But a new weapon of war was introduced in the 1990s, which was called free trade. Now, this was, again, winning the war without firing a shot, because America then willingly and voluntarily transferred all of its technology, its manufacturing, and its industry offshore into Asia. It wasn't somebody pointing a gun at America saying deindustrialize. It was America doing it at will in order to make short-term profits at the expense of the American culture. Now, here we are 25 years into this thing, and you can see that America is now swimming, absolutely swimming, in a sea of debt. In fact, the debt is so astronomically high, it's never been seen. This kind of debt has never been seen so much in the world before. And all of this debt, of course, is about to come home as a gigantic tsunami upon the American coastline, and probably this year. So when we talk about the tenets of disparity, we can see the disparity in terms of language. We can see the disparity in terms of currency. And we can see, and as a result, we can see the disparity in terms of the quality of life that is seen throughout the world. So we often talk, and we often talked in the 20th century, about the first world, the second world, and the third world. The first world being, of course, Western Europe, the United States, and Japan, or what we would call the trilateral world, that would also include South Korea and Taiwan and Hong Kong, who'd embraced this industrialization. Then the second world, which was the communist world, about which we knew very little, but that would be talking about the Soviet Union, and also talking about China, communist China. And then the third world, which was everybody else, who were living, in our opinion, far below our standards. In 1960, better than 50% of all the resources in the world were being purchased and used in the United States. That's how much the United States dominated the world in terms of its consumption. Now, this has since changed dramatically. And in fact, the changes began in the early part of the 20th century, and it's moved dramatically in different directions. So we now see, for instance, that China's GDP has eclipsed the United States GDP, when just a few 30 years ago, we were absolutely the dominant world power in terms of the highest GDP in the world, with the exception of what used to be called the country of Rhodesia. Rhodesia and South Africa were two enormously wealthy countries on a per capita basis, and they were wealthy because of the resource-rich environment in which these governments were placed, whether you're talking about diamonds, gold, or whatever. And so these countries really had a very high per capita income for each individual living in those countries. Now, that has since changed. since Western Europe and other forces took apart the apartheid regime in both Rhodesia and in South Africa. And so Rhodesia then became Zimbabwe and fell to actually the poorest country in Africa. And of course, South Africa is still struggling to hold on to its first world status right now. So, but when we talk about disparity, let's talk about what happened in Latin America. Let's talk about what happened in the continent of Africa. And let's also talk about what the kinds of pressures that were on in Central Asia and Southeast Asia, which were enormous. The pressure that was brought in Southeast Asia during the Vietnamese War, which was an absolute disaster for the United States of America and a huge tragic loss for the Vietnamese people in terms of the number of people who died, including civilians who died during that war and in the aftermath of that war, and which would then be followed by the dramatic events in Cambodia under the Khmer Rouge. These kinds of things have brought about a tremendous tragedy in Southeast Asia and a tragedy that required a healing that needed to take place and is still being properly addressed in order to bring the nations back into wealth. We can still see the struggle now is very reflective in Myanmar, where now it's out now war in Myanmar that's going on there in terms of these issues being settled in that neck of the woods. Maybe this wouldn't have happened if the French hadn't been growing heroin all over the Golden Triangle. But that is another story that has to wait for another day. We can see now, however, Indonesia, Malaysia moving strongly ahead, Singapore moving very strongly ahead as commercially very successful places, Vietnam moving ahead, commercially successful. Even the Philippines is pulling out of the doldrums. But when you talk about Latin America, where the Monroe Doctrine was imposed upon Latin America, and Latin America, which at all material times had the opportunity to succeed, particularly Venezuela and Brazil. These were two nations that had the opportunity to succeed every bit as well as the United States, but were unable to do so because they had embraced the tenets of socialism. And in embracing the tenets of socialism, they had restricted the free market, and they had restricted the free marketplace of ideas. And in doing so, they robbed themselves of their own opportunity for wealth. So when we look at the tenets of disparity, you can look primarily to a couple of things. One is, number one, at the top of the heap is there intellectual freedom? The next question is there robust laws supporting private property? If a person does not have private property, they do not fully have a complete right to life, because a person has a right to the tools of their own survival. It's a natural right. And so these things, the right of, to freely think and to freely speak, and the right to freely act within the confines of the social order, are the tenets that cause prosperity and all the boats to rise in the society. When those tenets are knocked down or when those tenets are restricted in terms of, gee, we need to pay homage to the ideas of collectivism, remember that when everybody owns everything, no one owns anything. And under those circumstances, poverty exceeds those who have wealth. In a free market, this is the place where all boats rise to the greatest level. That is to say, you end up with more people who are wealthy than you do the people that are poor and despairing. And it is then up to the wealthy to take care of the poor at their discretion. So under these tenets, I just wanted to share this with you. So we can see now that to the extent that China has embraced a market economy, to the extent that Japan has embraced a market economy, that Korea has embraced a market economy, that Russia has embraced a market economy, that India has embraced a market economy, these nations are beginning to prosper. They're beginning to move forward. They're beginning to do the things they could not do before, like, for instance, in Russia, where many of the economies of scale were built by force. And now they're not being built by force. They're being built by profit. And there is a big difference. So these tenets of disparity can be measured from a market economy to a state-controlled economy. When you get to a completely state-controlled economy, you get to the most impoverished state, places like Haiti, for instance. And the places in between the nations that have embraced socialism with the idea of, gee, we need to pay for cradle to grave care for the citizens. We need to have some element of free food. We need to have some element of free electricity. We need to have some element of free health care, free colleges, and so on and so forth. By doing that, there's no such thing as free. What you have done is you've taken the individual using the service and taken away from him the necessity that he pay for his own service, and you have instead replaced that with collective payment for the services, generally speaking. That's what's happened. It's not free. It's just the collective is paying the cost, not the individual. And when the collective begins paying the cost, things begin to round off. And as a result, in a socialist society, people do not get the health care that they want because they have to wait in line because everybody is in line trying to get health care at the same time. And this also, these socialized health care systems also take away from your defense budget, your ability to maintain other infrastructure, because you're spending it all on taking care of people's sniffles, if you will. All right. So with that being said, there's one other tenet of disparity that I think is really important to see here, and it goes back to our discussion of demography. And that is when you talk about sexual expression in the social order. Now, there's a very interesting book by Edwin Unwin is his name, Unwin. It's called Sex and Culture. It was published in 1934, and it's an empirical review of 84 social orders predicated on how they discipline their society in respect of sexuality. And the society that respects virginity unto marriage and then tries to codify a single marriage that lasts for life, that social order under that discipline, and it's a discipline because you're saying no to this and no to that, and instead it's this social order only, that discipline leads that society to become the head and not the tail, the creditor and not the debtor. It is by maintaining virginity under marriage and then getting married once and staying married. Those two practices lead a nation into the ultimate pinnacle of prosperity, and it causes you to become a leading nation. Now, it takes three generations to get there of this practice, but during those three generations, you can see the culture and the society move forward at a very rapid and successful rate. And even though people, you know, they tend to lose sight of the fact that, gee, we agreed to do this. We agreed to volunteer into this kind of a deal. And instead, you start getting the kind of harping we had in the United States that took us away from laws that protected marriage in this country and laws that forbid other sexual expression to a country that is now wide open. And you can look very clearly and you can see we had a balanced budget in 1960, 1961 under John F. Kennedy. 1962 was the last year that marriage was completely intact in the United States. 1963, states began to adopt no-fault divorce, began to open the divorce doors, and began to turn a blind eye to fornication and adultery and so on and so forth. And ultimately, this would lead to every state in the union adopting a no-fault divorce standard by 2012. Now, since then, we went from a balanced budget in 1962 to $35 trillion in the red. So would you say we become the creditor and not we become the debtor and not the creditor? I would say so. In 1962, we were the most prosperous nation on earth. We're not that anymore. In fact, our GDP is sliding quickly as compared to other rising GDPs. One of the fastest rising GDPs in the world right now is Russia. Russia is expecting a 5.4% growth rate this year. This is astronomical, particularly in lieu of the sanctions from the West, which have been imposed by myopic and ignorant people who do not understand that the dollar's value is only there because it is neutral. When it is no longer neutral, it is no longer valuable. Let me give you an example. Let us say that we create a prom note by which we're going to use to exchange it. And we say, okay, this prom note here is worth 100. whatever it is, it's worth 100. And so with this 100, I can buy that, I can buy this, I can buy that, and I can get this service. And you say, okay, well, I want to buy your service for the 100, and then I take the 100, and I want to buy your things for that same 100. That's great. Now, what happens when I start cheating? What happens when I rip that dollar in half? What happens when I devalue it? What happens when I say, you don't get to trade with it anymore because I don't like your opinion? Well, then guess what? Its value goes, it plummets. It's no longer worth 100. It's worth 50. It's worth 25. It's worth 20. It's worth 10. And so every sanction that the United States has engaged in, economic sanction that it is engaged in against another country, has cost the credibility of the dollar. And the people who are imposing these sanctions don't understand this at all. They're just like vagaries. What? I thought we were just being mean to these people and kicking them out of our beautiful little circle. Well, the beautiful little circle is getting very, very small. And ultimately, after you've kicked everybody out of your house, don't be surprised when you're standing there alone and you don't have any friends. And this is what's going on with the dollar right now. So the tenets of disparity have left a lot of nations without the necessary food to eat. They've left the nations being at the behest of other countries who simply tell them what to do and do not allow them to have autonomy, will not allow them to have their own opinion, will not allow them to not participate in a pandemic, will not allow them to run their own free and fair elections, will not allow them to print currency that's based upon a dollar or based upon a gold or silver. These things are cut off. And so as a consequence, people are not able to express themselves to build up a real society that can actually thrive and prosper in the world because they are intentionally impoverished by the bigger bullies on the block. So that's the disparity. Now, when we talk about the concepts of wealth, you know, one man's trash is another man's gold. And this is something that is very significant because you can see that for a nation to succeed in its own prosperity, you have to begin with the tenet that wealth is achieved from adding intellectual understanding to a natural resource. Okay. If I have a log, a log's a log. It could be used for firewood. It could be used maybe for a stick. You might be able to convert it into a baseball bat. But generally speaking, a log's a log. When I take that log and I cut that log and I shape it and I make it into a square or I cut it into a circle or I carve into it or I take it and divvy it up in pieces and then glue those pieces together in a different way, I'm adding value to the natural resource. And from that adding of value, which cost me nothing, it's an intellectual addition that goes to the natural resource. I add my intellectual understanding to the natural resource and it becomes much more valuable. And because it becomes much more valuable, now I can trade for a profit. And the profit was created where? In the mind, not necessarily in the reality. So if you are a nation who is shipping out raw resources, like in Africa, where they go in and mine diamonds, and then the diamonds are all shipped out, an African nation would do very well to mine its own diamonds and cut its own diamonds in its own country and retail diamonds of Angola or diamonds of Zaire, whatever, those being retailed from those countries. Now you have the value added to the stone. Instead of exporting the natural resource, you're exporting the finished product or semi-finished product. This makes a difference in terms of lumber. For instance, I'll give you an example. Canada has a very robust forestry, particularly in British Columbia and in some portions of Alberta. And in this robust forestry, you're talking about really some fantastic softwood timber from hemlock to fir to the different kinds of fir to western red cedar to spruce. Virtually all of the evergreens are grown throughout British Columbia, and they make fantastic construction materials, 2x4s, 2x6s, 4x10s, etc. And so the Canadians could say, okay, who's got the sawmills? Oh, the sawmills were all here in America. Great. We're going to cut our logs, put them on logging trucks, and then ship them down to you. You can cut them into construction grade lumber, and then you can market up, you know, a billion times to make a profit on the fact that you've honed it down to a specific size and you've kiln dried it. Canadians don't do that because they wisely understood that why would we ship a natural resource in its raw form to someone else when we can convert it in our own sawmills, paying our people good wages to work in mills to create construction grade lumber and then sell the lumber at retail, and we'll take all that profit for our intellectual edition. And so that's what they do. And so you see really terrific lumber coming out of Canada that's all been milled in Canada. So when we talk about the concepts of wealth, we talk about the idea that natural resources are one thing. Natural resources, before they are shipped out, a national interest is to add value to the natural resource before you ship it out. If your nation, for instance, is drilling for oil and has huge oil stocks, you want to have a refinery right there that's going to refine that into particular products and ship those, because then you have the profit that's associated with the value added, not just the natural resource. Okay, so these are concepts of wealth. Now, in addition to the concepts of wealth, there's really what's called the hard economies of scale. And hard economies of scale is the difference between the people who are engaged in adding value to natural resources, and they're going to be doing that in manufacturing, industry, textiles, and so on. They're adding value to the natural resource, in which case they're bringing in a profit, as compared to those who are just simply toiling at getting the natural resource and shipping it out. We go fishing for tuna, and then we take the tuna boats into another country and let them process the fish, right? You wouldn't do that, not if you expect to make, if you want to make the wealth. So keep that in mind when we talk about what is a one man's trash is another man's gold. Now, I'll give you another example when we talk about one man's trash is another man's gold. Right now, there is a huge fire burning in Kuwait. And this huge fire that's burning in Kuwait is a tire graveyard, tires that came off cars. It's the largest tire graveyard in the world, and it's currently on fire, and you can see the smoke all the way in space. Now, that, as far as I'm concerned, is a huge waste, because all of that, that entire tire farm, could be converted into energy through a process of pyrolysis using Tesla furnaces to convert all of those tires into energy. And from that would come energy, diesel fuels, so on and so forth, that could then be packaged and used elsewhere. Again, taking the resource that's there that looks like junk in a garbage dump and converting it now into a marketable energy product. This could be done right now. Nobody's doing it, but there is the ripe equation. Same thing with these gigantic blobs of trash that are floating around in the ocean. This too could be rounded up on a ship floating pyrolysis center, where these things could be ground up and placed into these furnaces, and then they achieve plasma, and from the plasma they're reconstructed with certain carbons to create, whether it's diesel fuel or jet fuel additive or whatever it may be. But all of these things, all of this trash can be reconnoitered and resequestered, and the energy reapplied by, again, using an intellectual process to convert that into wealth. Okay. So the idea that wealth is a zero-sum game. I'm wealthy because you're not. There's $10 on the table. If I can take nine of it and leave you one, then I've $9 richer and you only have $1. That's the thinking. Well, that assumes that wealth is merely finite. And wealth is not finite, because wealth is also an intellectual proposition, as is achieving wealth. So demand is an intellectual proposition. I want that. And equally true, supply is an intellectual proposition. Now, these are dynamic properties, supply versus demand. And it is not, gee, there's a limited supply, therefore there's always going to be a price. When you're talking about adding value to a natural resource, then yes, there is a limited supply. But that limited supply can be quickly factored over by a new concept that allows somebody else to supply the same demand with a different item that has maybe an infinite supply. So remember that both supply and demand are children of the consciousness. And so because of that, it's how you think in the intellectual marketplace of ideas that makes a difference as to what your wealth is. So when one man's trash is another man's gold, is that a zero-sum game? No, it is not. But In order to achieve a parity in the marketplace, you must have a free market. Now, let me give you an example. Okay, everybody can deal with used tires. Okay, we know we got the retail guys. They're selling the tires for a certain price. Everybody can deal in tires. And some people can deal in used tires, but not those guys. We're not going to allow those guys to do it. We're going to criminalize them. We're not going to allow that class of people to make it. We're not going to allow that nation to survive. We're going to bomb them. We're going to blow up their stuff. We're going to keep them repressed. We're going to take away their government. We're going to take away their ability to make a living. We're going to do this, that, and the other thing. This has been a methodology that's been used by colonialists now since the 1400s. And the question that the whole world has to ask itself at this juncture is there any room for colonialization any further? That's a big question. Do the nations have the right to their own autonomy? And when we talk about the nations having the right to their own autonomy, you know, who speaks the language? If this is the language that's spoken here, then that's a nation state. That's a tribal center. That is a nationality, if you will. And that nationality has the right to speak what it's going to speak. Let them speak. Let them be self-determinative. Self-determination and autonomy is the functionality of the sovereign state. And under the tenets of the international community expressed in the United Nations Charter on Civil Rights and on Human Rights, yes, each state has the right to its own sovereign determination to the extent that it is managing itself without applying elements of coercion and force against its neighbor or violating the rules of behavior in the interior of its country by engaging in genocide and other acts. Okay. When we talk about the forces of engagement now, the forces of engagement in the world, we're going to see some very interesting things. One thing we see in the Western world that's very dominant, the dominant force in the Western world, is Egyptianism or Romanism. And this is the philosophy, theology, if you will, and the practical aspects of the Roman Church coming out of primarily the Vatican. And the Vatican has sought to perpetuate the Western Roman Empire. And the Western Roman Empire, of course, was an entity that rose up out of the Roman Republic, became the empire under Augustus Caesar, and functioned until the early 400s AD. And then upon its collapse, was reformed as the Second Roman Empire, called the Holy Roman Empire, in 800 AD, or the Second Reich. And it collapsed in 1800 under the forces of Napoleon, and then was reformed again under the tenets of Adolf Hitler, creating the Third Reich or the Third Rome. Now, the Third Rome lost World War II, but has nonetheless captured the entire continent and did so by not applying elements of force. It did so by applying elements of intellectualism. Oh, look, we Germans don't want to rule Europe anymore. We just think it's a good idea for all of us to be in a common market where we can trade goods among one. Oh, that's a good idea. And, you know, we probably should have a common currency. That's a good idea. We should probably relax visa restrictions and travel restrictions between the countries. We should probably form a government called the European Union that governs our currency and our travel restrictions and our this, that, and our standards and so on and so forth. And the next thing you know, all of the ground that had been conquered by Adolf Hitler and the Reich is now under the auspices of the EU. And it is the children of the Reich that are running it. Well, who knew, right? So here we are. So you can see that that came back. And the elements of Romanism, which are expressed in the Roman Catholic Church, Rome has a huge control over both North and South America. Now, when I say that, most people don't want to acknowledge it, but it is a Romanist, that is to say a French Catholic, who is controlling Canada. And he is controlling Canada consistent with the tenets of the World Economic Federation or the World Economic Forum, with the tenets of the EU. And he is working with Chrystia Freeland, who is also a child of the Reich. And they have celebrated former Reich members living in Canada recently, giving him a standing ovation in Parliament. So when we talk about the Reich, remember that the Reich is the military arm of the Roman Church, of the Roman ideology. And so this is what the Reich was, and this is what the Reich is. And so you can see that this is French Catholic control in Canada. Now, no one wants to say Catholic control in the United States, but it's here. And it's one of the great tragedies, really, of the United States. In America, we're taught the American Revolution was such a wonderful thing. We became a free and independent country. No, we did not. That isn't what happened at all. We broke the bonds that held us to the Protestant Kingdom of Great Britain and then opened the door for the Romans to come through, primarily through Maryland. They came through in the United States, and at the hands of Thomas Jefferson, who perfected the First Amendment, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. That is, you cannot ban the Catholic Church by the means of the First Amendment. The Catholic Church was able to move in and to overtake the Protestant colonies that they couldn't overtake when they were the French trying to win the colonies, trying to capture North America. They couldn't defeat in Britain through a whole series of wars that went on for almost 200 years, until they finally had to understand and relinquish the fact that Britain was going to be a autonomous and Protestant enclave. And to this day, I mean, the Brexit vote in Britain represents the, again, the Protestant world pulling away from the Roman controls of Catholicism in the Central Europe. Now, in the United States, we can see that our friend Donald Trump would appoint four Catholic judges to the Supreme Court to complement the three that were currently on the bench there. So now we have two people of Jewish heritage and seven Catholics occupying the Supreme Court of the country. The current president of the United States is a self-confessed Catholic. Nancy Pelosi was a self-confessed Catholic running the House of Representatives. So you can see that the United States is primarily and, well, kind of obviously under Roman control, as is virtually all of Latin America, whether you're talking about Mexico or Venezuela or Brazil or Argentina or Chile or Ecuador or Peru or any of these other places. The Catholic Church is dominant in all those, although Venezuela does have some articulation coming in from Islam. There's many mosques in downtown Caracas. And the exceptions are, of course, Haiti, which is really a satanic place. They made a deal with Satan in order to get to break off the French yoke. And as a result, they've been the most impoverished place in the world since. And of course, Cuba, which I believe is a secular atheist nation with no tenets linked to any faith whatsoever. Other than that, we see Catholicism ruling the Western Hemisphere. So when people look at Romanism, they ask themselves the question, well, what's so bad about Romanism? What's wrong with this? And on and on and on. Well, you have to remember that Romanism was and continues to be at war with Orthodoxy. There was a splinter that took place in 1016 AD called the Great Schism. And to that end, there was the desire to terminate the Orthodox people, and which is what the Soviet Union was all about. 70 years of internal genocide at the highest possible level under the hands of Yusef Djugashvili, also known as Joseph Stalin. So Romanism has been really quite anathema to anything escaping outside the purview of these 13 families controlling the Roman Church. And except that, bear in mind that Romanism has also been influenced by the Knights Templar. Now, the Knights Templar factored in very large into the history of Europe. The Knights Templar being the organization that developed banking during the Crusades, particularly letters of credit. We call them traveler's checks today, but it's the same kind of thing, letters of credit, developed by the Knights Templar in the 11th, 12th, and 13th centuries. And then from there, when they were basically accused of being heretics, excommunicated from the church, and 32 of their leaders were executed by the King of France, only to have all of their property confiscated, and they were the largest real estate holders in Europe. The Templars broke into two groups. One group went into Scotland, and they would begin to move inside the Masonic order in Britain to create the Scottish Rite Masonic order, and also to dominate of Scottish Rite Presbyterianism. And so this was one half of the Templars. And the other half of the Templars went into Switzerland to begin to perfect their banking skills. And the Swiss banks were all predicated upon former Templars. So the Templars did not go away in any respect. And they have a great deal of influence inside the Roman community now, because banking is actually superior to the religion. Banking is superior to the religion. And when you think about what banking is now in the real world, this is essentially it. Imagine if I went to you, you personally, as a listener to this program, and I said to you, look, I'm going to give you a PDF here that is going to allow you to print $100 bills on your printer. And you can print as many as you want. Go for it. See you later. So you might sit there and start printing $100 bills, and they're all legal tender, right? You just have to sign them. So you're printing them and you're signing them. How long would it take you before you were the richest guy in town? I mean, you'd have that printer. You'd buy a couple of printers, and you'd have them going full time. All that, you got the biggest printer you could buy and have it going full time. And it wouldn't be long before you're the richest guy in town. They're pretty soon the richest guy in the state, pretty soon one of the richest guys in the world, because you're churning out this money. But now, what if I came to you and said, not only am I giving you the right to churn out that money as much as you want, counterfeit money as much as you want, but I'm also giving you a monopoly. You're the only one who gets to do that. And you can take that money and give it to banks or anybody you feel like and charge them interest on the money you're giving them that you're creating and you're counterfeiting. This is what the central bank industry is, and this is what the Knights Templar brought to the table when they created central banking following the demise of the Templars at the hands of the French king. Okay? So this is Romanism and banking. Now, one of the great wars that's going on currently is the war of Esau versus Yaakov. You might think of this as Esau and Jacob. Now, I'm not going to get very far into this discussion because we don't have a lot of time to deal with it, but it's part of the Abrahamic religions as well. But you can see that there, you know, when you understand that Esau gave up his birthright and lost his blessing and swore to kill Yaakov, that battle is still ongoing, and the house of Esau still rises up and is working diligently day in and day out to kill off the house of Jacob. That's what's going on. And I'm going to leave this discussion for another day. We can talk about it more in detail. But you can see the Abrahamic religions, Islam, Judaism, and Christianity, these are all Abrahamic religions. Although they're almost all of them are tainted with other influences, whether it be Buddhism or Egyptianism or Greek mythology or whatever, these things are all kind of imbued with different influences. Nonetheless, these three religions are going to occupy roughly about almost 4 billion people on the face of the earth. Now, there are other major forces that, of course, people in Asia understand, particularly when you're talking about Hinduism in India, and when you're talking about the atheism that is generally expressed throughout China and other communist areas. And so these kinds of tenets and secularism, if you will, these kinds of things are contrary to one another, but they are forces of engagement. And so you see that people who have grown up in Islam and have been, well-trained in the traditions, they don't want to yield for those traditions, even when they migrate into France or when they migrate into Britain or when they migrate into Sweden or any of these places in Europe that have been traditionally Roman Catholic or Christian. They come in and they do not assimilate with their religion, but maintain Islam when they come in. The same thing with Jews. The Jews maintain Judaism when they come into a country. I mean, there are many converts, but most of them do not convert. Most of them retain their religious identity. And these become forces of engagement in terms of how you understand the world. It's interesting to me that in Islam, they are expecting the 12th Imam, the Mahdi, to return. In Judaism, they're looking for the Messiah, Mashiach ben Yosef, or the Mashiach ben David. And in Christianity, they're looking for the second coming of Christ. So everybody is looking for this realization of the end days with their messianic hero, whoever this may be, to come back and change the world. And many of them, because of these worldviews, are intent upon creating the Battle of Armageddon, so in order to hasten the return of the Messiah. Now, finally, I want to talk about East versus West as the forces of engagement. Because what we see is now you have a situation going on where China was essentially under the radar and held down when it was primarily an agricultural society. So as long as we could keep China as an agricultural society, we didn't have anything to worry about with the half a billion people that live there. As long as India could not rise out of its poverty, we didn't have anything to worry about India rising up. So they were essentially ignored. Now, however, you see these economies moving up because their economies are moving up because they had the opportunity to embrace market economies. Now their economies are moving up. As Vladimir Putin just recently said, we're bourgeoisie now. We're bourgeois. So what's your problem? Now that we're bourgeoisie, we're no longer collectivists. We're no longer tavarishim. But then you guys should be able to come back and say, hey, yeah, great. You guys are now one of us, bourgeoisie. But what Putin didn't understand was they became bourgeois and we became a tavarish. We completely abandoned the tenets of the marketplace and have gone into communism. So East versus West is a very interesting game now. And it is one where the East has this market of scale that includes, 4 billion people. So if you've got 4 billion people, do you have buyers for your goods? Yes. Do you have sellers for your goods? Yes. Do you have people who can pick up the slack when you develop natural resources? Yes, you do. And so as a consequence, the West becomes less and less necessary. And the West becomes less and less efficacious. And this is one of the problems that happened to the British world, that it became less efficacious, particularly under the tenure of Elizabeth II, who created a warm and fuzzy cocoon for the British people and did so at the expense of British industrialism, British mercantilism, British seamanship, and shipping and so forth, and the British skill set in their building. There's still factories in Britain and so forth, but they are greatly reduced from their abilities that they used to have when they had steel plants in Wales, for instance, that are all closed. When they had mining going on in Wales and Cornwall, which are basically all closed. When they had agriculture going on throughout the country, which has been much reduced. But mostly the manufacturing has been greatly reduced and the industry has been greatly reduced. So the West now is in a shrink mode and the East is in a rising mode. And the problem with this is that there are people who want to fight over it. They want to have a war over it. And there's really no reason to have a war over it. Because I'm going to express this to you again. Wealth and prosperity are intellectual aspects. They are not done by elements of force. The element of force is a zero-sum game. When you leave the element of force behind and you use intellectualism by allowing a robust marketplace of free ideas and a manifest liberty that allows for the free market. Not, and I'm not talking about wide open anarchistic market. I'm talking about a regular market that has boundaries, that does not allow for piracy or fraud or counterfeiting. But other than that, it's a free market where people are able to share what they know and to share their inventions and to sell their inventions for a profit. This can be perfected by anywhere, anybody at any time and bring the nation into prosperity. Okay? So, and that's what could happen notwithstanding East versus West. Last, we're going to see one of the conflicting worldviews is collectivism versus individualism. And it is ironic because this is a pendulum which swings and you have one society pushes out towards individualism. And then when it gets to the end of individualism, everybody hates everybody and goes, we can't stand living with one another. So then they begin to start pushing back towards collectivism. Gee, wouldn't it be nice if we were unified as a single culture? We had a homogeneous culture where we all agreed on things. We were all one nation, one idea, one concept, one brotherhood. Oh, yeah, that's a great idea. So we start pushing towards collectivism. And the collective, who got all the way over to the far end that there was no identity left, everybody's just equally impoverished and equally enslaved, they began to seek individualism. And so those countries that were communist in the 20th century are now pushing towards market economies, and those market economies in the 20th century and are pushing towards collectivism. And these worldviews are going like this. And it's going to be a shock to the Western countries who were at one time individualistic as they push toward collectivism that they're falling into poverty. Well, guess what? If you want to be the third world, you're going to get there doing it, practicing collectivism. Okay. The last thing I'm going to talk about here, and then we're going to wrap this baby up, is corruption. Now, this is something that is really quite critical to our discussion here. And I'm going to stop our share here and just talk about corruption generally, because no society functions on corruption. So let's talk about this. The ultimate aspect of civilization is achieved with judges of high integrity. Okay. It's not achieved with the perfect king. That doesn't do it. What achieves the best aspect for your society when you become a civilization that is noteworthy is when you have judges of perfect integrity. And the ability to judge is something that belongs in the hands of the leader as well. So a leader's function is not to execute and to tell people what to do. I've decided everybody's going to go this way. That is not the function of the true leader. The true leader is to judge. This is the path that is going to be the best for our people. I've judged it to be the best path. This is going to be the idea that is going to best promote our country. This is going to be the best economic system we can use. This is going to be best for the families in the nation. This is going to be best for our culture. And the ability to judge, and to judge with integrity, being no respecter of persons, but rather being able to judge on the facts that are before you. Now, when you begin to see judiciary making decisions on who the person is that's being tried and their relationship to the other side, that is a corrupted judiciary. That's a corrupted judiciary. And once you have a corrupted judiciary, you have immediately fallen from a first world country to a second world country, depending on the level of corruption. For instance, it's one level of corruption when you have a judge making the decision based upon the political strength of the parties before him. Well, this man's a rich man, that man's a poor man. I'm going to find in favor of the rich man, period, because I might need to borrow money from him next week or whatever. That's one level of corruption. When you get judges taking bribes, that takes you from a second world country to a third world country, okay? And you're falling quickly. When you get to the point where it doesn't make any difference what the judges do, they're just corrupted, and it's a given. Everybody knows the judges are corrupted. You've lost your judiciary. When you've lost your judiciary, you've lost your civilization. Now, this recently happened in the United States with the corrupt trial of Donald Trump in New York, where this was, this was a far cry from, having a jury of his peers adjudicating facts or any of the rest of this stuff. Instead, it was just a railroad, basically a railroad to Rikers Island. And evidenced, and to the whole country, it is evidenced, a corrupt judiciary. Now, most people, if you were to tap most people in the United States and ask them if we have a judiciary left that has any integrity, they would all say no, there's nothing left in the judiciary. There was no judge. There was no judge that was willing to call Barack Obama on the table and say, hey, can you prove to us that you're an American citizen by producing a true and accurate birth certificate? No, instead, the judges called everybody who raised that issue a birther. There was no judge, not in any of the 50 states, that was willing to call Barack Obama to the table to force him to prove his American citizenship. Now, I want to try to make this point very clear. Barack Obama, or anybody in the United States, the only way you can prove your citizenship is through your birth certificate. That's how you prove your citizenship. And it has to be a bona fide birth certificate, because a fake birth certificate is a felony of major proportion under federal law, particularly if you're proffering a fake or phony or falsified or forged birth certificate for purposes of getting a federal position. You can go to jail for 18 years for that felony, producing that birth certificate. And so you have to produce a real birth certificate, and the real birth certificate has to evidence that your father was an American citizen at the time you were born, such that you can be a natural born citizen under Article 2, Section 1, Paragraph 5. This is what is required under the Constitution. You have to be a natural born citizen, which means you have to prove that you were born to an American father at the time of your birth. Nikki Haley can't do that. Kamala Harris can't do that. Ted Cruz can't do that. And neither could Barack Obama. In fact, Barack Obama's own admission is that his father was quote-unquote Kenyan at the time of his birth, even though we all know that there was no Kenya in 1961. It was British East Africa. It didn't become Kenya until 1964. And how was it that Barack Obama, this so-called Kenyan national, would be arrested in Russia in 2006 as a suspected MI6 spy for the nation of Britain? How'd that happen? That's a question for you. But at any rate, the fact that no judge would take that case on and challenge the president and say, produce the birth certificate, showed you that the judiciary was already compromised, was already completely compromised. And in particular, the New York courts are absolutely corrupted from one end to the other. So, but they're not the only ones. They're not the only courts that are corrupt. In fact, when you can't find a judge anywhere in the country to look at the idea of what's going on and tell the truth, and instead you get all this corruption that's going on, well, then you've lost your judiciary. And this last case with this prosecutor who was basically put in his position by George Soros, and then these charges that were non-articulated, they weren't even, where's the charge, the real charges? And then, of course, Trump gets convicted by a jury, not of his peers, but rather of a biased group of political activists working inside of a particular district in New York. So with this kind of corruption, the society now falls. Now, all the people who are smirking and laughing about the fact that Trump got convicted do not recognize that by winning that battle, they've lost their country. They've lost their country. And since this is the case, and this is something that that many people who are students of Buddhism or students of Taoism understand, that the pendulum swings out this way, then it swings back the other way. You perfect a sword in the hands of a left-wing agitator, then all of a sudden the pendulum shifts. That very same sword with the razor-sharp blade is now in the hands of a right-wing agitator, and he's going to use it on you. May not be the same person, but what you used over here is going to be used on you. So now you can impeach a president after he's no longer the president, which is what happened to Trump. You can convict, you can arrest and convict a president after he's out of office. Well, what do you think is going to happen if Trump returns to office? There's going to be a whole lot of people that are going to end up getting arrested and convicted, and they're going to be doing jail time. And there's going to be a whole lot of SWAT teams kicking in doors of people that use the SWAT team to kick in their enemies' doors. And why? Because you allowed your judiciary to fall. You allowed your judiciary to fall. So just keep in mind that when we talk about a civilization at its highest level, there's some points I want to make, and we'll make these points tonight in this geopolitical analysis. The first premise is that a society that protects marriage between a man and a woman and protects the virginity of children into marriage is the society that becomes the head and not the tail, the society that becomes the creditor and not the debtor. But it takes three generations to get there while you're doing that. So that should be priority number one for a true judge of a social order. The second premise is the society prospers the closer to an absolute free market of marketplace of ideas that you have, and a free market that results, a free and ordered market that results as from this free marketplace of ideas that is predicated upon robust free speech, that economic order is the economic order that's going to quickly rise to the top and is going to quickly become an expansive economic order, a fast-growing society, a fast-growing order. And remember that the key to prosperity and the key to making that intellectualism happen is to not allow natural resources in their natural form to escape your jurisdiction. No natural resource should leave without having value added to the resource before it goes out the door. That's in the state's best interest. Okay. Then the third thing that brings prosperity is maintaining the integrity of judges. And judges have to be held to a very high standard. No bribe taking, no payoffs, no kickbacks, none of this, no respecter of persons, but someone who is experienced in the law and who weighs the laws and the facts. Now, it's possible and it could be very possible that we may end up with AI as our judges, because at least AI is not going to be burdened down with emotions and kickbacks. Here's the facts, spit out the judgment. And it doesn't require waiting on somebody and their political weight. At any rate, I'm not advocating for that. I'm just saying that when, if you want your society to be a first world society, you have to have judges with the utmost, highest of integrity. Anything less than that is a corrupt judge who destroys your social order from the inside. Okay, so with that, my friends, I am going to wrap up my discussion tonight, the geopolitical analysis here on global TV, global television. And I want to thank Scott Bennett for allowing me to host in the show while he's gone. He's dealing with a number of issues on a worldwide forum, and I want to bless him in that endeavor. May his travels be safe, may they be worthwhile, and may he come home safely to us. And I also want to bless the audience that is listening to this particular program, that you will have, hopefully you'll be able to understand these tenets that I'm talking about, that I'm not too monotonous in my speaking, and that you will be able to see what this geopolitical analysis is before we get into some kind of a war, because there are certain elements passing in the night. One part of the global society is crashing and another is rising, and the crashing side doesn't like it and wants to beat up the person taking its place on the way by. And we should not allow that to happen. You know, there is a thing called graciousness, right? Bow out with a little bit of grace and have a nice day. Okay, so I'm going to thank you, my friends. Blessings to you. And we will see you again on Global TV, Global Television.